Howdy. Sebastian Bay is a research scientist and senior game designer at the CNA Gaming and Integration Program, as well as faculty advisor for the Georgetown University Wargaming Society. He has two commercial designs, Literal Commander Indo-Pacific with Dietz Foundation, and a multi-pack Crisis in Korea being released through Catastrophe Games. We discuss the challenges of designing on the topic of North Korea, the value of modeling hypothetical war, and commercial appetite for modern conflicts. So welcome back. You are my first ever repeat guest. Though I want to clarify, because last time you were on with Emily Yoder to talk about Malign. And so in my head, I kind of assumed she's the guest and then you were part of her entourage.
Yeah, that's how you should think about it. Yeah. I'm her entourage.
Like Turtle or something. Like you're part of the group. But it's great to have you back to discuss the Crisis in Korea release, which is, you know, two games in one from Catastrophe, and then also talk Literal Commander as well. So that's very exciting. I wanted to start by asking, how distinct is the partition between the design work that you do and designs you create for sponsors and the designs that you might bring to a commercial publisher?
Oh yeah. That's a great question. So I would like to say that personally, both realms sort of hit the same topics, right? They tend to be contemporary. They tend to be future oriented, which is very similar to my work, for CNA and the Center for Naval Analysis, in which I do professional wargaming. But in many ways, it's different because the work that we do here at CNA tends to be analytical games, and a little bit of educational of saying, hey, we have some decision, we have some plan, we have some contingency that we want to look at, right? That we want to produce data for that can be fed into military exercises, into military analysis, and then fed back again in sort of what we refer to as a cycle of research and analysis. So that's sort of very different. Like, you know, games when we play for entertainment in the hobby realm is like, is designed to have learning, and there's a little overlap with educational games of what we do here when we support educational gaming for what we call professional military education or PME. But vast majority of our work here at CNA tends to focus on analytical gaming. And that's really about producing data, insights, and informing other decisions and other forms of analysis. And the scale is just fundamentally different. Like, I've done analytical games that are like 400 people, right? So, and then you have other analytical games that are very minutia. And honestly, they are not fun. They're not fun. Like, we lock low stations into rooms and we're like, we're going to do a logistical war game for 5 days, and you're going to track every class of supply from MREs to blood packets to ammo of various types, right? And our poor low station players are like, please let us out of jail, right? So the emphasis on analytical gaming, it tends to be like, hey, can you produce us in useful information in the form of data or decisions or the rationale behind decisions, so we can take that to do more analysis to make better choices out in the real world. And the fun portion, although it is what we call often engagement, we want our players engaged and we want them to have some kind of connection to the decisions they're making, right? But at the same time, we are more willing to, in a sense, brutalize our players to get the information that we need from them. I always say when it comes to like analytical gaming, the game is like the juicer, and the players are like fruits that we toss into the juicer. And we're willing to do violence upon them to get the information that we need. And so there's that, right? So in the commercial realm, it is the exact 180, right? Even if the topic is the same, we will simplify, we will extract. We don't have to defend our choices often about our game design choices and so forth. And you have a lot more autonomy of what you want to look at, which I think is good, right? Because in the professional realm, our sponsors come with a question that they want to delve into, right? Or at least a semblance of a question. One of the things I love about, like, you know, let's say the KTO game, the Crisis in Korea, which is the KTO Crisis, and Loose Nukes, that those were both games that I just did with my students, or for my students, to get them understanding about game mechanics and a certain topic, which was really just, you know, a choice of my point. I love that autonomy and creativity. And you can combine a lot more things commercially, because it's more about the feeling, the experience, versus like, I need you to produce me particular sets of data, if that makes sense.
It does. It's a case study versus policy analysis. Yeah, but in this case, the case study is sort of like how the case is the students making the games, as opposed to, you know what I mean? Like, it's like even more process oriented, it feels like, than trying to get them to crank out some data when you lock them in a room. It's very interesting that there's very little consensus among folks who do kind of professional, like design professional war games. But one of the points that I do see a ton of overlap is the insistence that they are not fun.
They can be fun. Some of our players really enjoy our games, right? But like, for example, the tolerance for not fun mechanics, right, is much higher on the professional side, right? Because like, doing logistics is not fun. It's just, it's number crunching, right? It is accounting at its worst, right? But it is incredibly important for what we do, right? How much fuel you have in terms of barrels, right? And so forth. And we extract those things in commercial games, right? Even really heavy games, right? Like, let's say Empire of the Sun or whatever, that have really heavy rules, right? They abstracted it to the point when a professional player thinks about it, it's like, oh, like how many 10,000 barrels of oil is that, right? Keep a surface action group in World War II out. And you're like, I don't care, right? In the commercial realm, you're just like, I just need them to sort of think about, I need oil generally, right? But like, for professional players, they need to be like, okay, I have four different types of fuel, right? I have diesel, JPH, fuel for ships. Like, I have all these other types of fuel that I need to keep track of in barrels, because I'm consuming thousands of barrels, right, across a geographic region of half the globe, right? So like, that is not a fun task, right, for nobody, right?
Right. It's also interesting because it opens up a lot of tactics that you wouldn't, like, things, considerations for how you approach and engage certain kinds of conflicts, right? Like, if I thought that I had a adversary that where fuel was more precious to them, I might want to make them follow my scouts, you know what I mean? Like, along the borders, like kind of the borders of their airspace, just so they're using up fuel by always having to basically, like, you know, have send an air escort, like, every single time. Like, just like a lot of little things would be like, oh, well, I know that this is precious to you, so I want to make you, you know, expend some of it to very little effect wherever possible. But yeah,
that's really absolutely. And like, to go one step further, is like, in commercial games, like, we have interesting choices and often like multi-dimensional factors that affect our choices. But let's say I want to send an airplane against you, right? Often in commercial games, we're thinking about like, oh, am I going to lose that piece, right? Like, there's like these broad sort of force allocation, force risk sort of decisions, at least in war games, right? Or often like resource allocation questions, right? But for like professional gaming, we think of that, but like two steps or one step deeper, right? Or higher, depending on the type of game, of saying, hey, right, like, yes, I can send a squadron of aircraft to intercept your squadron, but how much fuel does that consume for me, right? And also, what does that mean for sortie regeneration, right? Like, those aircraft will come back, they need maintenance, I have maintainers, I need repair parts, I need fuel, I need munitions, right? All the little things that, like, games often, like, neatly abstract, which is good because they're supposed to be fun on the hobby side, right? Also be like a little too close to home for me, like, in the sense of like, oh my God, like, day job is my hobby now. So I think there's a balance there, and both sides have really good things they can do. I will say, for us on the professional side, for professional military education, PME, we do use a lot of commercial games, right? Because sometimes they're the right level of abstraction, the right level of discussion for a class to discuss on multiple topics, right? Whether it's, you know what I mean, looking at strategic events like the Cuban Missile Crisis and talking about escalation and deterrence or World War II campaigning and operational art. We use a lot of commercial games for that stuff. Like, I mean, Command General Staff College uses all sorts of games from Battle for Moscow, Race to the Rhine, Root, right? The German Command Staff College uses Scythe, right? Which has an interesting reason why they choose Scythe over other games. To look at those kind of choices in a classroom environment. So it's not to say commercial games are bad. It's just they have a different level of focus and emphasis in their design.
So that's a great segue into kind of talking about Crisis in Korea, the idea of two micro-war games that you designed, some dimensions of potential direct conflict with DPRK, and then releasing this as a commercial game. I was kind of curious if actually the best place to start would probably be, would you mind giving a synopsis of what you were modeling with these two designs and telling our listeners about them?
Yeah, so for Crisis in Korea, there are two games inside of it as a pair, which is one is KTO Crisis, and for KTO, it stands for the Korea Theater of Operations, and then Loose Nukes. And they all look at future-oriented contingencies on the Korean Peninsula between the DPRK, or North Korea, and the Republic of Korea, or best known as South Korea, and its ally, the U.S. And they look at it different perspectives because I wanted the game to be two things. One, really accessible and easy for players to get to play the game. And then also look at the conflict in the context of nuclear weapons and nuclear consequences. Because I think we often like circumcise or at least expel that notion from a lot of commercial gaming of the use of nukes and so forth. And I think that's really important on the Korean Peninsula. So that's something I wanted to focus on.
How did you balance the competing priorities of making a game that's like satisfies the needs of accessibility? That like, this might be a question that's a little bit larger, larger about like kind of microgaming in general, but I'm always interested in like how folks approach like balance of the need of accessibility that microgames tend to offer versus the demands for kind of external validity and, you know, really incredibly complex. I mean, when you're dealing with DPRK, for example, like there's just a wild bouquet of unknowns, right? So trying to have a model that would look valid, like even though it's heavily abstracted, at the same time, making a game that's extremely accessible for new players.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So I came down to the best way I have to think about it is boil it down to a singular dynamic or choice. And then make the game about that clear vision of around that singular choice. The best way to explain it is like, for example, KTO. KTO Crisis is part of the Crisis in Korea like set, looks at operational warfare, like broad, like, hey, how do I win the war with conventional forces with the shadow of tactical nukes and strategic escalation, right? Because like, if you think of like Next War Korea, right? That is like a tactical slash operational war game of like, I'm moving helicopters, I'm taking that hex, I'm moving this like zone of control, that sort of thing, right? I wanted to look like way above that and be like, hey, I have a bunch of forces and I'm trying to win the war. And with these forces that have allocated to me, but also at the same time, from the US and ROK perspective, I have to worry about how do I win this war without it going nuclear, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a question Next War doesn't really talk about, or other games, right? Because it's not fun, right? Because the DPRK player can, if they decide to go like, I'm going nuclear right away, like, I don't care what you do, I'm just going to risk nuclear escalation and set the tone, right? And they can do that. And the reason in KTO Crisis, they can do that because the game is like 15 minutes, right? Mm-hmm. If the player like ends the turn on turn one and you're like, okay, cool, like, let's play again, all right? Like, it takes then like less than a minute to set up again. And that's okay because I wanted them to feel like, yes, the DPRK one day, if they ever start our conflict, they can stay on day one unprovoked, just to launch nukes, right? To be preemptive or whatever. Or a lot of times in that game, when we have play tested it, the North Korea player will keep it in reserve until they feel they're losing the war, whatever that means to them, right? Mm-hmm. They'll reach a point internally, they'll say, I don't think I can win without using nukes, so I'm going to use nukes, even though I can risk losing the game for all of us, right? And that's also a dynamic I wanted the players to be realized, is that the other person gets to decide when their risk tolerance is up, right? When they're done. And there are other players that never use it because for whatever reason, right? But that's the singular choice that I wanted, our decision space I wanted my players to think about, right? I didn't want them to think about air power, naval power, any of that stuff, right? I wanted them to look at the intersection of nuclear use and conventional fighting and how those can push and pull against each other. Like, as I'm winning the war conventionally, whether as nearing the North Koreans or the alliance between South Korea and America, right? How does nukes shadow over it, right? Because one of the things that I loved about it is, like, I've played it with my students, and there will be a aha moment after like the third or fourth game where the US or RK player will be like, I can win more victory points, but I'm not, right? Because Dan will almost guarantee use nukes against me if I go any further, right? So right now, I'm making assessment that Dan can feel like he can still win. But if I keep pressuring my conventional winning, right, to like total success, nukes are going to come out, right? And that's really like the educational portion that I wanted that game to have, right? If that makes sense.
No, that's really savvy. As someone else who's designed a game in that area, it's interesting the opinions that kind of come back from people who don't.
And it could have been the first game.
Yeah, it could have been. It was possible for a beat there. It's interesting, like, you know, the opinions that kind of come back about the motivations of DPRK from people who don't really follow anything happening to put it mildly. It's, and I promise our listeners not to get into a long digression about maritime boundaries or abrogation of 13D. But it is interesting, like, you know, a lot of the incentive for when we kind of treat the incentives of like DPRK as being really opaque, or I should say Kim regime, kind of mm-hmm. differentiate a little bit, because it's all about whether or not the Kim regime feels like their annihilation is inevitable, whether or not nuclear weapons are going to be used, right?
So, absolutely.
In an interesting way, it is kind of odd. Like when I played Next War Korea many years ago, there was a lot of this is just Dan's opinion. I found it both needlessly complex, and fetishizing capabilities over relevant scope would probably be the way I would talk about it. And it was like a little bit interesting to, but it had a lot of let's pretend there aren't, you know what I mean, a ton of solid fuel propelled short range missiles just hanging out over the border, poised and ready to be fired, and let's mm-hmm. pretend there isn't enough anti-ballistics in the world to stem the swarm when it happens. It's just interesting, and that's like even pre like THAAD batteries being parked on the peninsula and stuff like that people mm-hmm. can talk themselves into there being a lot of safety nets that aren't really that, you know, like in a weird way THAAD batteries are more about the lone missile, or even if you wanted to foil the lone test or something like that, mm-hmm. Before finding out how cool a reentry vehicle is. But they're also like any other nuclear weapon, like a nuclear weapon being used, even the THAAD batteries have this element of like, they're kind of you're going to politically get your ass handed to you, like if you use it. Mm-hmm. So there is that element of it. But generally speaking, like with these conflicts, it is more insightful to see like what is going to be the impetus for players to use certain capabilities. And as they break into that next set of like, okay, our worst case scenario has been met, now we're going to break into this arsenal, or as it's basically interesting to see two players like choose when they're going to escalate things based on how well the war is being prosecuted. You know what I mean? If it makes sense. Like, yeah. I think that that's like the interesting decision space. So it makes sense that that's a short game. It's going to be informed. They can just reset it afterward. But getting them to ask those questions and kind of interrogate that is really excellent. And that's something that I really like seeing in general, like in games about modern conflict, that is kind of rare in some ways. And we'll kind of circle back to this when we talk about Literal Commander in a little bit. But I do think that that's an interesting thing. Like, that can be an issue with some commercial games about hypothetical kinetic conflict.
Yeah, absolutely. And I chose the Korea topic for those sort of nuclear intersection of operational art and nuclear use, because I think among all conflicts, Korea, any contingency in Korea, you cannot talk about it without nukes, right? The use of nukes, the shadow of nukes, right? What will happen? And KTO was looking at like, hey, if if the Korean War starts up again, right? Like, whatever choices you have at the big blue arrow, sort of like I'm moving forces up the DMZ or down the DMZ, right? Nukes are going to be part of that calculus of like, hey, is this 1 inch too far? Is this success too hard? Or like, did I win too spectacularly? Right? Like, I was watching my students one play one time, and the North Korea player lost the battle like pretty badly, just dice rolling wise. They had even sort of numbers ish. And the US player just gets a bunch of fives and sixes and just like demolishes them, right? Right. And as soon as their turn starts, they use nukes. They're like, I'm gonna use nukes right now, right? And I explain, like, hey, you can sort of end the game. They're like, I don't care. Like, I don't have enough forces to stop that now, right? Like, there's a risk calculus that I did, and I'm just like this is a regime threatening problems now. So I'm using nukes. And they use nukes, they ended the world, right? And we ended the game, and then they just started over again. But the second time they played, the ROK player, ROK US player, like, was much more cautious, right? And took more losses because of it, right? And I think that was the dynamic I wanted the players to experience, is like, hey, sort of like, what's that movie with, was it Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise, where he like relives the day over and over again? The Day After Tomorrow or something like that, right? Sci-fi movie. But
oh, that's, I know what you're talking about. But I can't remember the name of the movie, but it's the Tom Cruise one.
Yeah.
That's what you want. You want Groundhog Day, but with violence.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I wanted them to experience like what all the different ways nuclear apocalypse can come on the Korean Peninsula, and for them to walk away with it like, that is bad. Right. That is extra bad. And these are all the different ways it can go badly. And all it really depends on is the other player's perception of how bad it's gone for them. Right. And that's the core lesson that I wanted that game to look at. And loose nukes takes a little bit of a different experience or perspective on that, which is that one's a different scenario of, hey, Korea has collapsed. Because there's usually two broad scenarios that we talk about Korea or North Korea, which is they come across the border because they want to relive 1950, right? And you reunify the peninsula. And the other one is they collapse, right? They collapse under whatever pressure, right? Civil war. And then we're always like worried, like, what about the nukes? Right? Who gets to the nukes? And that's where Loose Nukes sort of looks at, is if the KTO crisis looks at 1950 redux, like, let's do it again, roll it back. Loose Nukes looks at it. Hey, if the Kim regime fails, right? And China, the US are racing to secure the nukes, right? Across North Korea while like this regime is falling apart, right? What does that mean for two nuclear powers to start chopping up another nuclear power, right? How do you not fight? How do you maybe coordinate? And there's a bunch of questions that are associated with it. And it was based on a RAND paper out in the unclassified website. I said it was talking about like the three dangerous scenarios. I think that's the name of the report. It's only like 10 pages, but I outlined a bunch of different ways like the Korean Peninsula could go sideways. And I read it and I was like, oh, this is so interesting. It's not a very good topic for a big sort of box game, but I was like, ooh, there's lots of interesting choices of like, if Dan is China and I'm the US and ROK and we're trying to secure nukes, but the more nukes I secure probably means I have a bigger hand in what North Korea looks like in the future after the dust settles, then there is a cooperation and also competitive aspect of that of securing nukes, right? Mm-hmm. Is that I want to secure more nukes than China, or China wants to secure more nukes than the US and are okay, right? But also at the same time, you don't want this collapsing DPRK house fire to actually use nukes while you're trying to violently secure their nukes from them, right? So there's like this interesting element where in that game, the North Korean element is sort of a bot, like a very simplistic bot that only does certain things in response to other things. But more than anything, there's an escalation track to it where if you allow the DPRK to sort of like escalate up and secure nukes to use against you, they will use it. The presumption is that they'll use it against both foreign powers, right? Which is excellently awesome in Doomsday, right? A collapsing North Korea regime used nukes on China and the US and ROK. Like, what better way to end the world? But that's sort of the setup I want them to do of like, how do we stay out of each other's way and secure nukes fast enough without knowing where all the nukes are in Korea, right? That's one of the things I wanted in the game to absolutely be part of.
Yeah. And that's fascinating because, well, for a lot of reasons. One, because our models for state collapse are based on states that have collapsed. And so you always have very poor comparables for future state collapse. You know what I mean? Like, you know, if you want if people want to point to like, say, you know, like East Germany or something like that, it's like, I don't think that's a good analog for what's happening on the peninsula. Personally, I think when you're talking about like securing like nuclear weapons and changing states, like I don't think Ukraine is a really good analog for that either. Like we just have a lot of bad examples is basically it. So it's a question worth exploring and kind of seeing how that would play out, even if we don't always agree on the volume of arms, why they were made, what they're there for, etc. Mm-hmm. It's like it's still a fascinating exercise. No, that's really cool. And two really interesting dimensions of that conflict to kind of explore is like an entry point for people who probably don't know that much about it.
Yeah. So for me, one of the reasons I did it this way was one, I wanted the players to look at the same thing from different angles, like that old like Roshan effect, right? We're all looking at the same object, but we have different perspectives. Hence, what we see is different, right? So that's why I wanted to emphasize in this game of like, when you play KTO, you look at it from a very different perspective and decision space, and you get a different lesson. But if you look at it from Loose Nukes, you're also looking at Korea and contingency on the Korea, but now you're worried about a very different problem. But I wanted that experience for all of them, right? Sort of in a set together. And my hope is maybe in the future do more of these where there's a series of mini games that look at the same problem set from different angles. And that's something I would like to do because I think a lot of times, typically, for at least like hobby wargaming, we either focus on the over kinetic portion, right? The tactical, the operational, the hex games, right? What a lot of people think are like traditional war games, right? By circumcising their strategic, by circumcising other elements. And then you have Euro war games that circumcise the tactical and don't connect down to like, what does it mean to like, you know what I mean, do this or X, Y, Z, right? So I want, and also want to look at it from different angles and tell different stories about how different conflicts and contingencies could unfold.
No, that's a really cunning approach, I think, because you have, when you're doing these micro game that are revealing facets of this conflict, mm-hmm. even though they don't have the deep dive with all of the minutia that, you know, would make 400 people feel trapped in a room. they're all trying to get at that nougat center to every conflict where they're gonna somehow like their mind's gonna be blown and they're gonna plumb the depths and really learn a lot about it. I think that the facets thing is interesting because you're just revealing different dimensions of this conflict that's actually going to give it depth because you're considering different questions as we're all looking at the same object to using your metaphor. And I think that it's tough because when, you know, typically when you're looking at presenting a commercial game, most folks wouldn't even consider the multi-pack approach to the same topic. They're trying to get one model to do too much. That's going to be the idea, myself included, by the way. It's like, how do I just bend the shit out of this to the point which it's really going to call into question what on earth I'm trying to explore or examine, or possibly even confuse players in terms of like what's actually being modeled. You know, you're trying to land this thing like where, like for No Mother Land Without, like my approach was more about trying to see how big the game could become while still incorporating a small personal story. And so the idea was like, I was going to try to have like this weird bifurcated thing where you have like a little generation track and we're going to talk about people mm-hmm. living in a society of surveillance, and some of them become elites, some of them defect, things like that. And then on the larger scale, it was going to be a matter of like, why is DPRK pursuing, you know, nuclear arms, and like, what is the West doing with its, you know, maximum pressure, you know, kind of campaign, and like maintaining sanctions regimes and things like that. So just like you were able to kind of give these different stories their space, but there's definitely like plenty of players who are just sort of like, I don't know what the hell this is trying to do. I think it's reduced, like there's just like a little bit easier to get buy-in from everyone because they know which game they're playing or even playing it for. So very cool.
Yeah. So, and I wanted to tell different stories of this because sometimes different stories are not rich enough, or we don't know enough to tell the full like box game, like the whole story portion of it, right? Like, or there's a volatile factor in the story that you're telling that you don't know, right? So for a series of micro games that I did with my students, I designed a couple of games on Taiwan, in a potential Taiwan conflict, looking at it very differently. And the theme I set for myself was the will to fight, right? The will to fight from our coalition, partners to join us in the Taiwan fight, right? Like that was the focus of that micro games. Like, how do I convince Korea, Japan, or Philippines to join any kind of potential conflict in Taiwan? And the Chinese players trying to like, erode that confidence, erode those capabilities so that even if they join the fight, they're not very good, right? And then the other one was to say, hey, let's look at the will to fight for Taiwan, right? But in the context of a naval blockade, right? Where I'm not landing thousands of PRC troops on Taiwan, but I am putting ships out in the waters to essentially strangle Taiwan into submission without ever firing a missile, right? And the US side is trying to do the same thing for the Chinese. It's like, we're going to do a counter blockade to your blockade, which is based on an unclassified Naval War College paper of like dueling blockades of like, but the thing about it is that, and the reason I did a micro game on it is because we don't know. There's a bunch of unknowns of that equation, which is we don't know how well the Taiwanese will fight, right? Or withstand a blockade of their island and their society mm-hmm. when you start running out of milk and bread and these things. Because sustaining Ukraine is very different from sustaining Taiwan when you have a lack of a land border that you can sort of like magic elf things across the border, right?
So it's a tiny island nation with like three Chinese lakes around it.
Yeah, exactly, right? So at the same time, right, like how much willingness is there for the PRC and also the broader Chinese society to also suffer from a blockade, right? When you have a billion people, right? What is your pain tolerance for stopping, right? And we don't know. So I have them as sort of like variables in the game where you can sort of roll for both those will to fight. So you can play a game where the Taiwanese will to fight is really low and you collapse real fast, right? But that also means that the US and the US player has to change a different approach where if there is a very low willingness to fight or endure a blockade, then maybe I'm putting all my ships into to fight, right? A big naval battle around Taiwan, right? But if they have a really high willingness to fight or to endure a blockade, maybe the counter blockade strategy is the right way, right? And I didn't want the game to be like, this is the right way to go about, you know, doing the situation. But I'm like, hey, these are how these variables connect to each other. And I want you to think about the Taiwan fight beyond what we often talk about in the media or even in games, which is, you know, like Normandy 2.0, right? Like, what does this conflict look like in different things? And it was also based on like a New York Times interactive article where they talked about how the Taiwan conflict could look in different ways beyond the typical, like, what we like to war game, which is like storm the beaches, defend the beaches, let's like war three it out across the Indo-Pacific. And that's something I wanted to look at. So that's, you know what I mean? I like these micro games because they're like little micro doses at a singular decision space, a singular dimension of our problem that I think are great for things that are volatile or also things that are understood or less understood or have lots of question marks, but also things that are like less told, right? About a perspective of a story, you know what I mean? To look at a particular problem set.
And that's a lot of what you're working on with your Georgetown crew, right? Like with your students.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So at Circle DC last month, I was able to meet some of your students. They were I thought they were an incredibly sharp bunch. They had really good questions and things like that. So I'm a little afraid for November, just you and me. I was going to ask, like, what have you gained from mentoring others? As with the Georgetown Wargaming Society, and how has it informed your approach and kind of core principles as a designer?
Oh, yeah. The first thing I will say about teaching game design to others is to be able to explain what happens in your brain sort of naturally or intuitively to you that is like not intuitive to other humans, right? So like, for example, Dan, right? When I ask you like, hey, how do you design a game? Like, how do you build decision space, right? How do you define that for a game, right? You already know in your brain, because you've designed games over and over, there is a certain art to it, right? A certain feel to it, that it is describing color to blind people, right? Mm. When that person has no literacy in games, right? All right. And often we as gamers, explain things in the use of other games in reference to other games. Like I did it a couple times during this thing, right? Where I'm like, oh, like in Empire of the Sun or using this mechanic. But if they don't understand those references, you have just spoken French to them, right? Mm-hmm. But how do you translate the thing that you're trying to do in terms of game design and what games do without referencing other games, right? As sort of your touchstone of reference, right?
Yeah.
And that was honestly really hard to learn, right? Of saying, hey, games are about decisions and decision space. And how do you build that mental model, what I call a schema? And I had to like look inside myself and my own design method that happens in the synapses of my brain, sort of like as I whiteboard ideas and be like, take a step back. I'm like, why did I whiteboard that, right? How did I get to this idea? And really autopsy my own design approach to be able to make it into a PowerPoint slide that says, this is my steps, right? Right. And it was honestly a lot harder than I imagined, because in my brain, I would smash a bunch of processes together, like because I will skip through them or like blend them because they worked in my brain. But to someone who's doing it for the first time, you can't just say like, you know what I mean? Invest money, make profits, get rich. Like you cannot have those as your three steps, right? You're like, all right, what do you mean? Like invest? What does that mean? Right? What are we investing in? And that's the part that I think I have learned the most as a game designer personally in the act of teaching and mentoring other students and other designers, of being able to be like, hey, what do you mean that this game design does this? Or how do I get you to do this? And how do I explain what I thought and how I got to this game design choice or research wise, how I got here to you when you're not literate in games? And I think that's really the thing that I learned the most. The other thing I would say is like my young students will always surprise me with their creativity, because a lot of them are not gamers, and they're my class is the first sort of, you know, interaction with them with any hobby game, with any professional game. So they come at it like, you know, tabula rasa, right? Like, they are blank slates, and they will discover, sometimes they'll discover mechanics, right? And I'm like, oh, like these nine games do these things. And they're like, oh, damn, right? But other times they actually think of like a really interesting thing. I'm just like, ooh, that is interesting, right? Like, I'll give a perfect example. There was a game one of my students did on the 1979 Vietnam and China, Chinese and Vietnamese War, right? The the Sino-Vietnamese War. It's a weird conflict. It's understudied for a lot of reasons, mainly because both sides like said they won and nothing was achieved, right? But how do you create a game about that, right? Also, how do you define victory objectives in a game, in a conflict where both sides adamantly say they won the war, right? Mm-hmm. Right. So they thought of this really interesting mechanic, which I've never seen, which is they created a XYZ like quad chart, right? So it's something you see in math. And they created these strike zones, right? These victory conditions, there are victory zones where if you can maneuver the condition of the war into the zone and staying within the zone for three turns, you won, right? But the clever thing about it is that they define the X, Y, and they're like, hey, we think the number of cities and the risk of widening escalation were the key factors in this conflict, right? For both sides. Both sides either wanted to expand it or wanted to control escalation, right? Because the Chinese didn't want the Soviets to intervene and so forth, right? But also like controlling urban centers was a huge portion of this conflict, right? They all sort of like rushed to control cities. Or recapture cities. So they're like, hey, this is what we want. But the not only the strike zone, right? So there's like this one marker that's like moving around this sort of quad chart. But more than anything, they had these sort of like secret events, right? That if you crossed a zone, you would trigger it, right? So how you got to your strike zone mattered, and how you got to stay there, right? So because you could still have more cities and just enough, you know what I mean, escalation that you stayed in your strike zone. Or you're like, hey, I'm going to move it over and then like move it up one, whatever. Because the strike zones wouldn't be on one axis all the time, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a really clever way. I was like, oh man, like I would have never thought this is really clever. And they thought of that because they didn't have any of our own biases of what we think victory conditions should look like, right? They're like, oh, like victory points or victory cards or like there should be things on the map, like things that we think are normal and build our game literacy. And also in their way, did not have any of those references or have very little tangibility to it. And they're like, oh, like none of these things you taught us fit. So we're going to build something sort of funky and weird. And I was like, this is really cool. Right. And that was honestly my favorite part of their game of how they define victory conditions. And I'm just trying to find a way. I'm like, there must be a game that this thing would look really cool in.
That's incredible. And, you know, in part because we don't often give a lot of thought to how victory objectives in games or victory itself is determined politically. Like it's decided what is important, what mm-hmm. we're playing for, what we're winning. And then, you know, there's more than one party that's deciding these things for given sides. However, you know, and to your point, there's an element of as students who don't have as much familiarity with a lot of other kind of commercial games and with they're not an encyclopedia of mechanisms out of their inexperience with playing a lot of those things. As a result, I think like when you gain experience, sometimes a lot of your solutions to design problems or your design approach is about rearranging the deck chairs to see if you can form the model, right, based off of, but it's like a compositive thing based on things you've seen already.
Yeah.
Whereas when you don't have that language, you know, I was thinking about in terms of like kind of music, like where if you think of music more as a language and less as like a expertise, or just like, you know, acumen, like it's that we all have the ability to communicate with an instrument, but some of us are going to be learning to communicate kind of like a child does. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. it's like a little bit of mimicry, like playback, but you're going to stumble on kind of unintentional poetry all the time. It's a matter of, can you get back to it? And then other folks have like this sense of why things work and how things get slot in, but it's very mm-hmm. hard sometimes for them to just let go and play and like be playful, like in that
space. Oh yeah. And I think about it recently when I saw a slight tangent is like, I saw, Ed Sheeran or whatever on like an Instagram reel say like, hey, I can play all these songs using only four notes or like four chords, right? And he's like, and the whole point of the song is like, all these songs that we think are unique are really just compositions rearranging the deck chairs of four chords, mm-hmm. right? And I was like, crap, do we do that, right? And I think a part of it's because sort of like the science of food, right? where I read a lot of random things, right? So to keep my creativity and my perspective wide as a designer, and like the science of food, of how much sugar, how much salt, right? Like chip companies have gotten down to science of like what hits your pleasure zone for different demographics, whether you're American or French or, you know, I mean, Japanese. But similarly for music, right? Those four chords are really popular, so they tend to be prevalent in many like popular songs. And this thought made me think introspectively of like, do we do it for games? Are there like things, like mechanics that we go to as designers because we know they're popular, because they're easy, because they're blah, blah, blah. And I think, and I thought about it, I was like, yep, worker placement, that's like in a million games, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so forth, right? And I'm like, when's the last time we think of game or like a game mechanic that was funky or weird or innovative, like truly innovative, right? Sometimes we think of games as innovative because they've rearranged the deck chairs in a formation or configuration that we haven't seen before. And sometimes that is really innovative depending how you did it, right? But like, I was thinking about it, and I'll ask the question to you, you're flipping the chair here, right? Where like, when's the last time you thought of a game mechanic or anything in a game that you're like, damn, that's like fresh, new. I've never seen that ever before.
It's, you know, encountering it in other people's games. They're always the games that I feel where it's miraculous that they were published. And when I encounter it in my own design work, it's usually how the hell am I going to get this published? It does feel like it needs to be a little bit derivative in order to tie into player expectations, because players don't want to feel lost or dumb, and you don't want to make them feel lost or dumb. But when you're trying to articulate like a new mechanism, or you have a system that's built around a thing that players haven't seen before, you're also kind of looking ahead to like, well, what is the rule writing portion of this going to be entail, and how difficult is this going to be for people to play, and things like that. So I kind of get that. And, you know, kind of coming back to the music metaphor for a quick moment, like it's sort of like, well, why are a bunch of songs like 110 BPM, 120 BPM and 4/4 time? It's like, cause that it's not just about that's naturally what people like, but it's like people enjoy songs derived from other songs that people like. Like there's this lineage of games that we play that are kind of capturing elements that, you know, within the design scope, there's a lot of designers who incorporate elements into their designs that are based off of games they enjoyed and how it made them feel as a player. And then now it might not even work in the context of the model. It might not actually be apropos to the thing that they're trying to design, but they like it. And so they want to shoehorn it in there without regard for how it functions in that context. And it's interesting because it's refreshing, because when you're talking about your students, they're working it out in terms of just, they're thinking about the design space where like, it's basically all about the model, right?
Model.
But then afterward, they are literally like going off to a corner trying to reinvent the freaking wheel.
Yeah.
And you're just like, there are wheels. And there's a wheel factory, right?
And I try to help them, right? Mm-hmm. But I do like it that way in some ways, because I always tell my students, it's about the mental model, the schema that undercuts your game. Every game has a schema, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, not every game has a schema. I'm like, no, it does. Like Risk has a schema. It's a very simple schema, which is mass equals probability of success, right? Mm-hmm. That is its fundamental schema that even children understand, right? Is that more people equals more dice means more pain that can inflict upon you, which means I can win, right? And that's a schema that people catch on real quick. That's pretty much the extent of it, right? and control, but like that is the core schema. And also the fact that there's certain territories that mean more to get me more than others, right? So the region system, right? But and then people are like, oh, Axis and Allies, right? That has a schema. It has a schema that different types of units have different benefits. Planes go further, they're more lethal, they're more expensive, right? There's this sort of like category of lethality, lethality and their movement, and then also their costs, right? For all these units, you're like, well, for one tank, I can buy X number infantry guys, right? For one artillery, I can buy the combination of XYZ, right? There is a schema underneath all games because they all have to make some sense of the world, the decisions and consequences and how they interact with each other. So like, that's the thing I always tell my players to be on. Like, if you build a very clear, very well understood and defensible schema, then the question just becomes, how do I represent this line or this thing with a game mechanic? Is it a card draw? Is it a resource allocation game, right? Where I'm placing meeples, right? And this is the part that I always badger my students who are really good commercial game designers, right? Because I'll get one or two a semester that are hobby gamers and they're like, yes, war games. So like, I know this, I play lots of games, and they come and this is often the problem with them or these types of students is that they have tremendous game literacy, but they skip the schema portion, right? They just arrange the deck chairs of game mechanics. And my first thing in their first assignment will be, why did you choose this game mechanic? Right. And they're like, well, it's a really cool, I thought it would be like an interesting thing. But I'm like, but in the real world, they do not randomly draw capabilities. They plan capabilities. Right. And like, this is a cool mechanic and maybe you can get away with it in a commercial game. But in the real world, for education, which you're trying to do for my class, you have to be like, why am I using this mechanic? And they're like, okay, cool, cool, cool. So they ended up changing it. And every time, almost the most common question I do on their assignments is like, why did you choose this mechanic? Where did you get these numbers? Why did you do it this way? Right? Why did you make this trade-off of emphasizing X versus Y? Right? Because fundamentally, I want my students to understand how to really hone and defend their schema and then the game mechanic stuff. Because game mechanic stuff, I can be like, hey, what about you take this mechanic or look at this game, right? I can guide them along that path and that can be increase their game literacy on their own. But like to teach you how to really build a schema, that is the hardest portion for my students. And they struggle mightily with it for the last like 6+ years I've been teaching. It is something really hard for them to wrap their brains about how to do that.
I will say even in the course of like, you know, doing publishing, you know, multiple designs, it's a thing you get better at, right? Because you already know you're going to have to defend everything, every choice you made and everything you do in the same book that you're
presenting. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's like, oh, why the hell did I do this? You know, and it's interesting too, because it's the opposite. Those students are the opposite side of the struggle that you're kind of trying to connect this, this education with games or the potential to educate with games. You know, it makes me think of, actually, we talked about this a while back, probably a year ago, but it was, you were telling me about the playing cards that they would give Marines that had like different weapon systems on them and relating it to the capability cards they used in Literal Commander. Mm-hmm. Right. And like the idea of like how you gain this familiarity with the system and, you know, really it makes me think of, your Horns of the Dilemma code designer, Betsy Joslin, who I talked to, had made, you know, in her interview, she was, talking about you're teaching subject matter literacy instead of expertise, right. Kind of leaning on that. But your approach in Literal Commander to those, capabilities and the overall scope of what that game's handling was really interesting because you could see how it's, you know, even when you have a basic schema, like what are you trying to teach players foremost? Like what's the primary thing? But there's all these kind of ancillary details that you can help rope in to that, to what you're trying to get across, that as much as you want to plumb the depths of that as a designer, sometimes it feels like you're just going against the grain in terms of like, oh, I could have made this very streamlined and very easy, but here's this one chunky detailed portion that I just like, and I want to keep it.
Yeah.
And I think players who are interested in the same topic might be. But yeah, it was, you know, can you speak at all to your approach in that, that particular design?
Yeah. With the cards for Littoral Commander.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I would say it is probably the part that people either love or hate about Littoral. It's really interesting because, like, I'll see BGG report like comments and like reviews of saying like, I will give this game a 10 if it didn't have the cards, right? Like literally, that's one of them. And I was like, okay, cool. Like whatever, you're still giving me eight, so I'll take it, right? other people are like, the cards are the best part about this game, right? They're like 10, right? Whatever, right? Some people are like, I remember because it makes me laugh, which is like, this isn't a war game. It's a resource management game with cards. I was like, well, wars require resources and you do need to manage them to win them, right? So I don't take it offense, but there's many reasons, both schema wise, but also design wise, why I made them. And that's why I was very comfortable with making them. Was one was I wanted the players to focus on the decision space of the commander, which they were embodying, which was like a battalion or company, or at most a regimental commander, right? And if you're at the regiment or the battalion level, you don't get to like, you know, plan how the F-35 comes to you. All you do is like ask your boss, can I have some F-35s on at like 3 o'clock on Tuesday, right? To do some close air support, right? So that's one portion. And one of the other things I always tell my players when I teach that game is, in the beginning when you're doing your planning stages and you have a certain level of command points, I say, hey, this mechanic's representing that this entire deck is the U.S. forces in the Indo-Pacific. You, as a battalion commander, as, you know what I mean, fighting the Luzon Straits, fighting the Okinawa battle, whatever, right? Get a tiny, tiny percentage of that because other people are fighting the war, right? Also at the same time as you, right? You don't get the whole deck for yourself to do whatever diddly things you want. You're like, you get 15 points worth out of this whole deck. The whole deck is available to you. You only get 15. You only get this tiny slice of it, right? So choose carefully what you're asking your boss to give you, right? That's the first thing. And the other thing is like, hey, what are the choices that you need to do before you leave your base to go? Because there are consequences that are locked in, right? If you left engineers at home, they're not coming to you in the middle of combat, right? You have left Kadena, you have left, you know, Camp Courtney, and you left those guys behind. And I wanted that choice to happen up front, right? Like, I want them to have a plan and walk into the game first turn with a plan of like, I chose these cards with my teammates and because we're going to do this plan. And then as soon as the plan tries to execute, they either go really well or most typically they goes really poorly, right? And that's why I wanted. And the other sort of pedagogical reason of why I chose the cards was to sort of what you said I talked to you about, which was I wanted them to serve as like flashcards. I wanted them to think of them as like recognition, but also like I wanted them to understand like all these things in the sense of like, hey, this is what a DF-21 looks like. This is sort of what they do in the game and why it impacts my level of decision making, right? And so forth, right? And because there'll be cards where people are like, oh, that card is really bad or really good, right? Because X, Y, Z, right? And I'm like, oh, yeah, like I just to have that sort of notion of like racking and stacking, like, oh, this card is not high probability of kill, but it gives me lots of dice to roll. So I'm willing to do that, right? I need volume, right, from this thing, right? I need really high precision, right, from hypersonics or whatever, right? I want to do something nefarious and terrible, like cyber or electronic warfare. And I wanted my players to be able to do that. And the cards were a great way to modulate difficulty in the game, where I give you like all the 112 cards for one faction, it can be overwhelming if you have not played, right? Right. But often when I play with people, right, I would be like, here are 30 cards for this scenario. Only worry about these 30 cards. Don't worry about the other like 80 because they're not relevant to you, right? We're just going to talk about these 30 cards. And even then, they'll choose down to like 6 or 7. And so forth. And then eventually I increase, as you know, as you get to play cards and you get to internalize what they are, then you get to know more, right? I know, like, I wanted the same effect that Call of Duty and like other like sort of like first person shooter games had for kids, where they were like, I know what gun that is because I play with that gun all the time, right? But I wanted it to be with a broader set of capabilities of like, hey, I know this capability because it's the card that I go back to all the time when I'm doing these kind of scenarios. I know what these unmanned vehicles do and so forth. And I wanted that level of literacy that was more important than just like identifying different types of cool guns, right? In Call of Duty.
Yeah. There you had, you know, it's interesting because it fed so well into, well, I understand that it's a bit of a, a barrier that you have to overcome when playing literal Commander, like that familiarity with the cards. Like there's a tutorial where it just tells you these are the cards you're going to start out with, which is next, like a very smooth entry point into that. But for me, what made it a standout, like that's one of my two favorite war game releases from last year. And I think it's because its strength is a team game. And I just love team games in general. There's not enough team war games, I think.
Yeah.
But it's in part because you have, you know, often what I would do with that game is I'd play it with someone as a two-player game. And then once I had that opponent, like kind of learn the ropes, the next time we played, we would be on opposite teams, but then we would be responsible for kind of getting our teammates up to speed. And there's a way for them to check rules and things like that. But there's also someone to kind of advise when we're picking out our capabilities at the start. And it's interesting because even when you have a teammate and they brought all the wrong stuff with them, all the wrong things, it's more about, they are responding to a different set of anxieties than you are.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And some of the scenarios are purposely built that way.
Yeah. And I think that that's really cool. Like I think as a design wrinkle, that's excellent. But yeah, so definitely first, I think team play is another part of that that could kind of overcome that. And I'd like to see that played more in that way, especially at like the events and cons. Like, I'm probably going to bring it with me to Consum World because I really want to get friends to kind of, you know, pack both sides for some of these and treat it more as a kind of team engagement because I think that's where the game really sings. But, you know, in response, like, because that was definitely something you probably thought of when you were designing it as like more of its practicality in kind of a classroom setting, right? For it being more of a team war game.
So I did teams because I wanted the team dynamic where they could be converging or divergent incentives, right? Like in Luzon Pass, which is one of the relatively beginner scenarios in the Pacific version, there is two ground Marine Corps elements that are sort of they're sort of identical, and then for the Chinese, there's this maritime force of ships, and then there's a ground component. And the reason I built the ground on the PLA side that way is because I wanted them to have sort of team dissonance, right? Where the land component is worried about like the land fight, right? Where they're worried about like landmines. They're like, one of the fiercest cards I get is like, I want more air defense, right? And then the Navy guy's like, I don't need air defense. All my ships have air defense. And they're like, yeah, but none of my ground dudes do, right? So it's always interesting to me how teams will work together, collaborate, or diverge, right? I've seen every little version of it where, let's say Dan and I are playing a game, and let's say some players will be like, Dan, you get 7 points, I get 8 points, let's just like call it a day, right? Other times, it's like, hey, like let's have 15 points that we all sort of choose like together, right? Like collaboratively. Or some people are like, hey, I think these are the most important ones and I don't care about the rest of the seven because I need these, right? So I've seen every sort of like configuration of team play. But I said it's really important because I wanted people to understand that like command relationships, that connection to other people, right, is really important, right? And how you fight the war as people, right? And this is something, a theme that I've always taken away from like World War II readings of history, right? Of like MacArthur and Nimitz and Halsey, like how like, people forget, like, we split the Pacific along a line because Halsey and King and MacArthur hated each other. Like, isn't that insane? Like, two men made it, like, we fought a war at an industrial scale because, like, these two men could not get along with each other, which is, like, and Nimitz, too, right? So, like, isn't that fascinating? And that's why I wanted the players to understand it because to this day, I have Marines that remember when they play with me. They're like, hey, Dan was a jerk. He didn't give me any air defense when I needed it. He didn't reveal himself, even though he could have. Like, I still remember that treachery, right? Or like, hey, like, there was one time, which is always interesting. There was an army guy and he's like, hey, we should get like a ballistic air missile defense for this scenario. I think they're going to go really heavy on ballistic, like fires. So we should buy THAAD and buy Patriot and really like boost up those things. But they're expensive, right? For the game. And the other team is like, ah, we're not worried about that. We have like air defense, but like, and, but he's like, no, but like ballistic is different. Like they're not going to interest him. He's like, they're like, we're not worried about it. We're going to do all these like drones and like bombers and stuff. And they did. And they, he got voiced out and I was listening to it, as they're talking quietly. And I was taking notes. And later on, like the first turn, the Chinese team just unloads like four ballistic cars, like bam, 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 right? And I had to like bite my lip from laughing out loud as like they got their logistics destroyed, their air defense destroyed, one of their ships got destroyed. And you can see on the army guy's face, he was like biting his lip. And then they play out, they end up losing. And the first time we're like having this sort of like after action report, after we do the game and sort of like, what do we learn? What does the game do well? What does it leave out? All this stuff. And the first time that shoots off, bam, is this army guy, this major. And he's like, hey, he's like, I argued for ballistic missile defense, blah, blah, blah. And his team was just like, head down in shame. But like those are the things I wanted, because I wanted people to have that conversation, force that conversation among players of saying, hey, I bring this. This is what I think is important. Okay. I think this is important. How do we navigate these things? Right. And I wanted that portion of it, but also at times be allowed myself as a designer to make situations where there is internal conflict on a team purposefully, because of the victory conditions, because of the command points and so forth.
Yeah. No, it's great to be grading in that way. And then also it's great when you're the player who gets outvoted on on a certain capability or a certain way, certain tactic. And then you're like, well, I'm going to be available later with I told you so's. And if you need me for like a Senate subcommittee hearing or anything, I'm happy to show up to whatever. That's very cool. I was kind of curious, I always like to wind down by asking people what they've been playing recently that's been capturing their imagination.
Ooh, what has been capturing my imagination? I don't know. I've been playing a lot of my students' micro games as we just wrapped that up on the Indo-Pacific, and we're starting a bunch on Europe right now, but so those are all fresh on my mind. I have a couple of like commercial games on my table right now, like Task Force is on there. Mm-hmm. David Thompson's Divided Europe is on there, mainly because I'm trying to dig through games that look at influence, right? That do it different than Twilight Struggle.
Yeah.
So that's on there. Task Force is on there. One of my students, Robert, is trying to do nesting egg approach to micro games, looking at Kosovo. So he's from Kosovo. So he wants to look at that sort of a Kosovo conflict from the strategic, the operational, and at the tactical level, in a sort of mini game, micro game stacked upon each other. So like what choices you make at the strategic level feed into your follow on game at the operational level, which will feed onto your game at the tactical micro level. Which I think was a cool idea that we're just kicking around, and we played a couple versions of it. And then Rachel McVicker, who's another young game designer at Georgetown, she did one on electoral influence operations in Taiwan, about this like push and pull of like, hey, how do I get people to be pro-American or pro-China on an issue? And that could be problematic. So I'm looking at a couple different themes that are really sort of looking at it. But right now, my obsession is like what we in the professional world call MDM, which is misinformation, disinformation, and malign influence, or something like that. So that's sort of like, I want to look at sort of influence of how we look at those non-kinetic things that are not fighter jets and bullets, right? I have this sort of notion of like, hey, and this is a mini game that I want to maybe grow out to a bigger game of like the autonomy of like social media influence, right? Which is, I've been reading a lot about like influencers, right? In general, like why do we pay a bunch of people on Instagram to like post photos or have endorsements, or why does we have public affairs or PSYOPs and all these things? And the issue that I've sort of been toying around with is the notion for Ukrainian aid, right? Is this notion of like, if I make a game just about that question of like, should we send Ukraine aid and how much, right? And having influence sort of be, use influence as a commodity that will push legislation through, right? But that is like laundered and affected through social media and Facebook and all these other things. It's sort of like a rough idea that I'm trying to do of like, how do I generate influence? And how do I move influence from Twitter to congressional influence, right? Those are two different things, right? But Twitter influence can migrate that way, right? And we have seen it happen, but it is hard. It is difficult. So just because you're really good at one domain of influence does not mean you can leverage it to do the thing that you want, right? It's this sort of notion I'm trying to get at. And I'm sort of like tinkering with it. I have like literally a bunch of note pages of just half-baked ideas that I'm looking into. But that's why I was looking at Divide to Europe and so forth. So that's something I really want to look at. And I think I like the idea of telling more stories about civilians in conflict, right? With things that are happening in Gaza and Ukraine and other places of like, hey, how do I tell other stories beyond just the stories of militaries roaming cities and hexes and conquering these places. And that's something that's interesting to me, at least on the hobby side for me, because I don't get to do a lot of it at work, because a lot of work is like, you work for the Navy and the Marine Corps, like this is the perspective we want, right? I'm like, okay, fair enough, right? So, you know what I mean? Like games like Grizzled or This War of Mine, right? Those are things that are percolating. And I'm not sure if I want to go all the way over there in that direction, right? But is there a way to sort of your idea, right? Like, is there a way to weave these stories together where I can show where they touch, right? And that's sort of the idea. So I don't know. If that interests you, Dan, let me know.
I'll keep you posted. It sounds like my thing. That sounds like my usual BS in general.
Yeah. And in typical fashion, I don't think about like getting published because I'm just like, I just want to design games for designing games. This is something that when Cole was talking to my students last week or a couple weeks ago about how he approaches game design with like John Company and Root and stuff, and it's like, hey, it's all about telling stories. And what kind of stories are we telling and from what perspective and for what audience and so forth. And I'm like, we need more. And we have more diversity of conflicts, right? Diversity of perspectives increasingly in our wargaming field, right? But then I think just because we're telling the military story of Asian militaries versus European militaries, That's progress in a horizontal sort of scope, right? But I'm also thinking about how do we tell different dimensionalities of stories, right? Like I was mentioning before with the micro games of like, how do we tell stories about different elements of a conflict beyond just militaries meeting on the battlefield?
Our thanks to Sebastian Bay. Outro music provided by Finom. They've got a new record coming out on May 24th, and you can find that and their other work on Bandcamp. Lights came until next time. Focus, they had 1,000 fingerprints, perfectly symmetrical, floating in your head. But you weren't sure just how. You're sick from all the yesterdays, but they're dying now inside your life body. You're alive body. Oh, I was shaking. Waterfall.